Real quick, we have to take a break to acknowledge the sponsor of today's episode, which is Secret Nature. Secret Nature's ultra premium CBD gummies are crafted with real botanicals, nothing extra, and designed to fit right into your day with clean, purposeful functionality. So for me personally, I like to take one of their snoozer gummies in the evening to unwind and ensure that I get a good night's sleep. After a long day, especially when my brain is just still running a mile a minute and I can't seem to settle down, I'll take one to help me slow down, unplug, and actually get a good night's sleep. I personally don't drink alcohol because I just don't like the way it makes me feel the next day, but these gummies feel very clean, intentional, and it never leaves me groggy the next morning, just feeling balanced and rested. Secret Nature's gummies are organic and farm grown. They're never lab made. They're ultra premium CBD gummies made with real botanicals and nothing extra. You've got two purpose built options. There's Bliss for clear focus and productive flow if you want to take one during the day, and then you get Snoozers to help you relax and rest at the end of the day. Each gummy has consistent, measured CBD, so there's never any guessing, just clean, reliable functionality that fits naturally into your schedule. Get 30% off your first order at secretnature.com with the code MAMA. That's M-A-M-A. And just a heads up, their Black Friday sale is coming up, and they are going to be offering 25% off on orders of $75 or more, 35% off on orders of $125 or more, and then 40% off on orders of $150 or more between November 26th and the 30th. So don't forget to use my code MAMA when you check out. That's M-A-M-A at secretnature.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy to see if you could save when you bundle your home and auto policies. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Did you know that parents rank financial literacy as the number one most difficult life skill to teach? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app for families. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on your kids' spending with real-time notifications. Kids learn to earn, save, and spend wisely, and parents can rest easy knowing their kids are learning about money with guardrails in place. Try Greenlight risk-free today at greenlight.com/Spotify.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. Now, I was looking for fun ways to tell you that Mint's offer of unlimited premium wireless for $15 a month is back. So I thought it would be fun if we made $15 bills, but it turns out that's very illegal. So there goes my big idea for the commercial. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. New customer offer for first 3 months only. Speed slow after 35 gigabytes if network's busy. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly.
And I am your co-host, Austin.
And today I am bringing to you a highly requested episode. Kaylee Becerra, this one is for you.
Woo-hoo!
We're talking about the Menendez brothers.
That was probably really loud.
Oh my God.
All I know about the Menendez brothers is that there's a basketball card of, I can't remember the player, and in the background, the Menendez brothers are sitting in the stands and you can see them on the card, and supposedly they had murdered somebody and were at this game.
Mm-hmm. And that's all Austin knows. So,
do you think that's interesting?
I do think that's interesting. Weren't they like floor seats?
They were real close, yeah.
Yeah, I wonder if it was after the murders.
I think it was right after. That's what makes the card so crazy, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that would make it crazy because that's a lot of money for some floor seats at a basketball game.
Yeah.
And it'll blow your mind once you hear all the facts.
Yeah.
So the Menendez brothers, Lyle and Eric, are names that have been swirling around in the true crime space for decades. It's one of those cases that hits all the marks for a headline-grabbing story. A wealthy, seemingly perfect family living in the beautiful Beverly Hills of California, brutal murders, claims of abuse, and two young, attractive men on trial for killing their parents. But the story of the Menendez brothers is far from straightforward. It's not just about the night they gunned down their parents in their Beverly Hills mansion. It's about what led up to that moment, what happened afterward, and the years of secrets, trauma, and pressure that shaped their lives. Whether you see them as cold-blooded killers or victims of a toxic family dynamic, one thing is certain: the Menendez case is one that still captivates and divides opinions even today. The Menendez brothers' story begins not with the tragic events of August in 89, but much earlier with the lives of their parents, Jose and Kitty Menendez. Jose Enrique Menendez was born on May 6, 1944, in Havana, Cuba, to a family of athletes. His father was a former soccer star, and his mother had been a champion swimmer. Jose inherited the competitive spirit of his parents, excelling in numerous sports, including basketball, soccer, and swimming. And he was the kind of person who always pushed for first place. Failure simply was not an option for him. Now, by the time Jose was 15 years old, however, Cuba was in turmoil. Fidel Castro had come to power, and the political unrest consumed the island. Jose's parents decided it was too dangerous for their son to stay in Cuba, so they made the heartbreaking decision to send him to the United States, while they remained behind to protect their property from the Castro regime. Much of their wealth was eventually confiscated by the government. When Jose arrived in the U.S. in 1960, he had nothing but his ambitions. He lived in his cousin's attic and just adjusted to his new life by throwing himself into sports, which provided a sense of stability. His dedication to swimming eventually earned him a scholarship to Southern Illinois University, where he would meet the woman who would become his wife, Mary Louise, or Kitty Anderson. Now, Kitty was born in Chicago in 1941 and had a similarly competitive and high-achieving nature. She was a beauty queen who had won pageants and had a desire for success in her own life. Kitty and Jose met at SIU in 1962, and it wasn't long before they were dating. By 1963, Kitty had graduated, and Jose decided to leave school, too. The two eloped and started a new life together in New York City, where Kitty worked as a teacher and Jose enrolled in Queens College to study accounting. New York was a tough city to live in during the 60s, but Jose's work ethic was relentless. While he studied for his degree, he worked as a dishwasher to make ends meet. It wasn't long before the couple became parents. Their first son, Jose Lyle Menendez, was born on July 10, 1968 in New York City. Kitty then left her teaching job to focus on raising Lyle while Jose continued to pursue his career. Despite Jose's growing success, New York's hectic pace was not ideal for a young family. After a few years, the Menendez family moved to Blackwell, New Jersey, where they could have a quieter, more suburban life. In this environment, they welcomed their second son, Eric Galen Menendez, on November 27th of 1970. By this time, Jose had moved away from accounting, discovering a passion for the entertainment industry. Jose's career in the music industry took off when he landed a top executive role at RCA Records. His success was swift. He signed big acts like Duran Duran and other popular music groups of the 80s. And as Jose's career soared, the family's wealth grew, and they moved into a million-dollar estate in Princeton, New Jersey. The Menendez boys attended Princeton Day School, one of the most prestigious private schools in the area, where their father's expectations weighed heavily on their young shoulders. From a young age, it was made clear to Lyle and Eric that they were expected to excel, whether it was in academics, sports, or anything else that they pursued. Jose was determined that his boys would follow in his footsteps to achieve greatness. And they didn't have the option of just trying their best. They were expected to be the best. Both boys gravitated towards tennis, a sport in which they excelled under the guidance of expensive coaches and private lessons. Lyle was a good player, but Eric truly thrived, eventually earning a national ranking in tennis for the under 18 category. Kitty, meanwhile, was the boys' biggest supporter. She was always present at their tennis matches and tournaments, cheering them on with pride. To outsiders, the Menendez family seemed like a picture-perfect American success story. Jose was at the top of his field, Kitty was the doting mother, and the boys were well on their way to living up to their father's lofty expectations. But all was not as perfect as it seemed. Behind closed doors, the Menendez family was anything but perfect. Jose ruled the household with an iron fist, and the pressure he placed on his sons was relentless. Lyle, being the eldest, bore the brunt of his father's high expectations, and he was constantly pushed to be the best in both academics and sports, and anything less than perfection was met with very harsh criticism. The pressure to attend an Ivy League school, particularly Princeton, was drilled into Lyle from a young age, and Jose had made it very clear that anything less would just be a failure in his eyes.
Gosh, no pressure.
Adding to Lyle's difficulties was the fact that he began balding at just 14 years old. And I personally wonder if this balding was because of the immense stress he was under. I've heard of people balding at a young age, not 14, but I have heard of people balding like in their 20s because they're so stressed with school. It's often doctors or like people who are in, you know, school to become a doctor. Mm-hmm. That I hear about literally their hair falling out and falling into their textbooks because they were just so stressed from all the studying they had to do.
Really?
Yeah, but I just wonder if he started balding at 14 because of all the stress. Mm. Now, in an effort to maintain the family's image of perfection, Jose forced Lyle to wear a toupee to hide his balding. And this, of course, only served.
What the hell? Yeah. So he's so pressured to make him be successful, and then you're bald, and so now you need to wear this because... Like,
it's all about image.
That's wild.
But this, of course, only served to intensify Lyle's insecurities. And Jose's obsession with appearances extended to all aspects of his son's lives. And it seemed that nothing they did was ever good enough. While Lyle struggled with academic expectations, Eric dealt with a different kind of trauma. Years later, during the brothers' eventual trial, Eric would reveal that his father had been sexually abusing him from a very young age.
Shit.
And this is a claim that would divide public opinion because not everybody believes this, okay? But according to Eric, the abuse was ongoing for years and he kept it hidden from anyone and everyone, including his mother and older brother. Now, Kitty, meanwhile, had her own struggles. By the time the family moved to California in the mid-80s, her mental health was deteriorating. Jose's infidelities were no secret to her. He was known to have a lot of affairs. But she chose to stay in the marriage, possibly because she didn't want to lose the lifestyle that they had built, possibly because she wanted to keep their family together. Oh, I mean, you just never know why people stay in those situations. They have their reasons, I guess. But over time, Kitty became more withdrawn, battling depression and substance abuse. And so she turned to alcohol and prescription drugs to cope with the growing tension in the household, and her relationship with her sons became more strained. Now, despite these internal struggles, the Menendez family continued to project an image of success to the outside world. In 1986, Jose left the music industry to pursue a career in film production, and the family then moved to Calabasas, California.
Ain't nothing cheap there.
No, I think that's where like Justin Bieber and the Kardashians live. I mean, probably where all they
live. That's where all kinds of them live.
Yeah. And they rented a home while their dream house was being built. A luxurious mansion on a hilltop with sprawling views and plenty of space for tennis courts and entertainment. By 1987, Jose was working as an executive at Live Entertainment, which was a struggling company that he managed to turn around. His first year saw profits increase by $8 million. And by his second year, he doubled that number. With his ruthless business tactics, Jose solidified his reputation as a powerful figure in the entertainment world, but he was deeply disliked by many of his employees. He was known for being intimidating, aggressive, quick to fire anyone who didn't meet his impossibly high standards. And Jose's professional life really mirrored his personal life. Nothing short of perfection was acceptable. Now, as Lyle and Eric grew older, they started to push back against this suffocating expectation that was placed on them. And Lyle, having failed to live up to his father's standards at school, began rebelling in other ways. He started hanging out with the wrong crowd, and soon Eric followed in his footsteps. Together, they began committing petty crimes, the most significant of which was a series of burglaries. The brothers broke into the homes of their wealthy friends, stealing cash, jewelry, and other valuables.
It's tough to call that a petty crime.
Well, so, yeah, for sure. And I have to wonder if all of this was just to literally rebel, because they have everything they could ever need. They don't need to steal cash or jewelry or valuables. They're living in Calabasas.
What's the
motive? So what is the motive, unless it's just to rebel against the pressure you're under at home?
Despite your parents.
Yeah. Their biggest haul came when they stole over $100,000 worth of goods from one of their friends' homes. And for the Menendez brothers, these burglaries weren't about the money. It was about the thrill. It was a way for them to exert control in a life where they had very little autonomy. They weren't stealing because they needed the money, obviously. In fact, their family was already incredibly wealthy, obviously. but it seemed like they were just testing the boundaries of what they could really get away with. Their luck ran out, though, when a friend that they had cut out of one of their heists then ratted them out. The police got involved and their parents were notified, but Jose's reaction was not one of anger over what they had done. It was anger over the fact that they got caught. He wasn't upset about the burglaries themselves. He was upset because they had failed to pull them off cleanly and successfully.
And so his image was tarnished.
Mm-hmm. So Jose's solution was to make Eric take the fall since he was still a minor, while Lyle, who was now an adult, was spared of any serious consequences.
What? Like, what message is that sending your kids?
Exactly.
On top of all the other messages you've been sending your kids.
Mm-hmm. So Eric was sentenced to community service and was required to attend therapy as part of his punishment. So this is when Eric began seeing Dr. Jerome Oziel, and this is the therapist who would later play a very important role in the unraveling of this entire case. So in 1989, the Menendez family moved into their dream home, a sprawling $4 million Mediterranean-style mansion in Beverly Hills. The house, located on Elm Drive, was the epitome of luxury. It had 6 bedrooms, a tennis court, a pool, even a guest house. It had previously been owned by celebrities like Elton John and Michael Jackson.
Sheesh.
From the outside, it seemed like the Menendez family had truly achieved the American dream.
$4,000,089, according to an inflation calculator, is the equivalent of just over $10 today.
Yeah, and I would have to imagine that in Beverly Hills or Calabasas, well, it's even more than that.
Yeah, because housing's had more inflation. Housing's like the leading factor in inflation for the last several years, so you're probably right. It's probably like $4 million is like $25 million.
Yeah. I want to say, and this is just off the top of my head, so it could be wrong, but I want to say that the home that we're talking about sold at one point for $17 million. But I don't know if that's because of the house prices or just because of the notoriety of the home.
So I just looked it up, and as of March of 24, so very recently, the home sold for $17 million. However, Strategic Property Analytic President Orel Anderson told the real estate listing website that he estimates that the Beverly Hills home sold at roughly 25% below prevailing market values.
Because of the notoriety.
Due to the notoriety. And
so that's interesting. So it had a negative impact on the sale. Yeah. Whereas sometimes
was the murder in the home?
Yes.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
That's wild.
But like sometimes I feel like that inflates the price because it's a notorious
right
home. But here we see the opposite. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So beneath the surface, the family was really falling apart. Jose's relationship with his sons had become increasingly strained. Lyle had been expelled from Princeton after plagiarizing a lab report. And despite Jose's efforts to pull strings and offer them a bunch of money, the university refused to reinstate him. Jose's disappointment in his sons was palpable. He had sacrificed so much to give them the best opportunities, and in his eyes, they were failing to live up to their potential. Now, Eric, though, was still excelling at tennis, and he was grappling with the emotional fallout of the sexual abuse that he claimed to have endured for years. In therapy, he began to open up about the abuse, but he still hadn't confided in Lyle. And I don't think that at that point, he had confided in the sexual abuse, but more so just the overall abuse and the toxicity within the home.
Mm-hmm.
As tensions in the household reached a boiling point, the brothers began talking about an extreme solution to their problems. They believed that killing their parents would be the only way out of the oppressive, abusive environment they had grown up in. Whether driven by fear, resentment, or a combination of both, the Menendez brothers made a plan to murder their parents. On August 20th of 1989, the Menendez family spent the day on a chartered yacht shark fishing off the coast of Marina del Rey. They had a sense of foreboding as crew members later recalled that the family seemed unusually disconnected from one another. Lyle and Eric kept their distance from their parents, and the atmosphere was obviously tense. That evening, Lyle and Eric left the house, allegedly to go see a movie. They claimed they tried to see License to Kill, but when it was sold out, they settled for Batman instead. Afterward, they said they went to Taste of LA, which is a festival, before heading home. This would later form the basis of their alibis. Meanwhile, Jose and Kitty Menendez were lounging in their den, watching TV and eating ice cream.
Clueless.
Clueless. The den was located in the back of the house, which was a cozy, dark room where the couple often retreated in the evenings. Around 10 p.m., Lyle and Eric entered the den armed with shotguns. And without hesitation, Lyle shot his father in the back of the head, killing him instantly. Kitty, startled, tried to escape, but Eric, panicking, missed his shot. Lyle took over and shot her in the leg, bringing her down to the floor. Kitty attempted to crawl away, but the brothers left the room to then go reload their guns. And when they returned, Kitty was still alive, but barely. So they shot her several more times, including a fatal shot to the face that left her unrecognizable.
Oh my gosh. Brutal.
The brothers then carried out a calculated move to stage the crime scene in an effort to make it look like a mob hit. So they shot their parents' kneecaps, which was apparently an act known as kneecapping that is sometimes associated with organized crime killings. And the idea was to throw off the investigators and make them believe that Jose, this powerful and controversial figure in the entertainment industry, had been killed by enemies in the business. So at 11:47 p.m., Lyle then made a frantic 911 call to report that someone had killed their parents.
Beverly Hills Emergency.
Yes, police.
What's the problem? What's the problem? What's the problem?
Someone killed my parents.
Pardon me? What? Who? Are they still there?
Yeah.
The people? What?
No.
So I know that call is kind of hard to hear and there's a lot of static, but Lyle is the one that made the call. And in the background, you can hear Eric screaming. Lyle is trying to tell the dispatcher, someone killed my parents. The person who did it is no longer here. He's yelling at Eric to get away from them. I think he's referring to the parents because Eric is in the den. So you kind of just hear a lot of chaos.
It sounds very legit. Like, I mean, which I imagine, even though he did it, obviously, like, surely it wouldn't be tough to be upset and still be frantic to make it sound legit. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Like, even though you did it, there's still a lot of trauma. Just
still like, holy shit,
it.
I just killed somebody. So now, I mean, it's not hard to get on the phone and be screaming
and be hysterical.
Frantic. Yeah.
Yeah. So when police arrived at the scene, they found the brothers hysterical. Eric collapsed on the front lawn. He was shaking, hyperventilating with Lyle trying to comfort him. And the officers on the scene were really struck by the boys' apparent grief and found their emotions to be genuine. The crime scene was gruesome. Blood and body parts were scattered throughout the den. In fact, one of the investigators on the scene recalled seeing parts of Jose's brain fall out of his head and onto the floor while they were there investigating. Because, like, the wound in the back of his head was that severe.
Wow.
Yeah. The bodies of Jose and Kitty were so mutilated that they were nearly unrecognizable. And it was clear that whoever had killed them had done so with such a level of brutality that was far more personal than just a typical robbery or home invasion. Now, initially, the police bought into the idea that this could have been a mob hit. Jose's position in the entertainment industry had made him some enemies, and the execution-style killings combined with the kneecapping seemed to kind of fit that theory. And the brothers claimed that they had been out for the evening and returned home to find their parents dead. So police found the brothers' alibis to be credible, and they didn't even test their hands for gunshot residue, which is a standard procedure in most homicide investigations that whoever is at the scene, discovers the scene, they get tested for gunshot residue to at least rule them out. But the investigators seemed convinced that Lyle and Eric were innocent and that they were these grieving sons who just stumbled upon this horrific scene. And I can understand that because you wouldn't pull up to this mansion in Beverly Hills and assume that the sons are capable of killing their parents in such a brutal way. Mm-hmm. It's just not what you would expect, I'm sure. So in the days following the murders, the Menendez brothers took on the role of devastated children who were terrified that the killers might come after them next. They moved out of the family home and moved into hotels, claiming that they were too scared to stay in the house. They hired bodyguards and even began wearing bulletproof vests. But as time passed, their grief seemed to kind of transform into something else, something more like indulgence.
Were they under investigation?
I don't know if they were under investigation at this point, but their actions that followed definitely piqued the interest of investigators. So in the weeks and months that followed the murders, Lyle and Eric began spending their parents' money with reckless abandon.
Which I just looked up, that basketball card, they are indeed floor seats at the game right behind the guy passing the ball in the card.
Yeah, and it's after
the murder. And it's after the murder and before the arrest, it said.
Mm-hmm. So on August 24th, which was just 4 days after the murders, Lyle bought 3 Rolex watches on the day before his parents' funeral.
Yeah, what are you doing, commemorating your parents' funeral death with buying yourself a watch?
3 Rolexes. And like, why is that even on your mind? Like, I remember when my mom died, I wanted to just buy a dress that I could throw away because I didn't want to memorize it. You know, I didn't want to memorialize it with an outfit that I'd have to look back on and be like, oh yeah, that's what I wore to my mom's funeral. I literally bought a black Old Navy dress, threw it away the day after. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's hard for me to understand that, but I also didn't kill my mom. So at the funeral, Lyle and Eric showed up late. They were dressed in brand new expensive clothes, and several people noticed their odd behavior, particularly Lyle's casual demeanor. He made jokes about his father. He made comments about filling his shoes, which was a reference to his new shoes, and even talked to a friend about how they could score tickets to the U.S. Open. This is at the funeral.
That's weird.
Mm-hmm.
Weird behavior.
Yes. The spending did not stop there. Lyle bought a $60,000 Porsche and spent $550,000 on a restaurant in Princeton, which he renamed Mr. Buffalo's. He also started a new company called Menendez Investment Enterprises, hiring his friends from Princeton to work for him. And Eric, though not as extravagant as his older brother, still indulged in luxury. He bought himself a Jeep Wrangler and paid for private tennis coaching that cost $50,000 a year. Now, while Lyle and Eric were enjoying their newfound wealth, they continued to live in the family's Beverly Hills mansion, though they had replaced the blood-soaked furniture in the den with new pieces. And at one point, which I would just board that room off. I don't know that I could ever move back into that house, but I would certainly not be able to go back into that room. Mm-hmm. But at one point, they considered moving out and had even placed a deposit on a $900,000 penthouse and then ultimately decided against it. Instead, they rented 2 adjoining condos in Marina Del Rey, where they threw lavish parties. The brothers seemed to be living their best lives, seemingly unaffected by the brutal murders that had taken place in their home just months earlier.
And shocker, running through money that they didn't have to earn.
Summer's here, and Nordstrom has everything you need for your best dress season ever. From beach days and weddings to weekend getaways and your everyday wardrobe, discover stylish options under $100 from tons of your favorite brands like Mango, Skims, Princess Polly, and Madewell. It's easy, too, with free shipping and free returns, in-store order pickup, and more. Shop today in-stores, online at Nordstrom.com, or download the Nordstrom app.
The Disney Plus Hulu Max Bundle. It's the ultimate bundle for an unbelievable price. Plans starting at $16.99 a month. Get it and watch Marvel Television's Ironheart on Disney Plus.
I want to build something iconic.
A new season of The Bear on Hulu.
We can make people happy.
And the epic, a Minecraft movie on Max.
Anything you can imagine is possible.
The Disney Plus Hulu Max Bundle. Plans starting at $16.99 a month. All these and more now streaming. Terms apply. Visit DisneyPlusHuluMaxBundle.com for details.
4th of July savings are here at the Home Depot, so it's time to get your grilling on. Pick up the Traeger Pro Series 22 Pellet Grill and Smoker, now on special buy for $389, was $549. Smoke a rack of ribs or bake an apple pie, this grill is versatile enough to do it all. This summer, no matter how you like your steaks, your barbecues are guaranteed to be well done. Celebrate 4th of July with fast free delivery on select grills right now at the Home Depot. Subject to availability.
That was given to them.
Mm-hmm. And they're acting entitled because they've always been entitled. They've always been, this is how they were raised.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as time went on, detectives began to take notice of the brothers' behavior. Their spending spree raised eyebrows, and the fact that they didn't seem particularly interested in the investigation into their parents' murders was suspicious.
Right. Imagine you're the lead officer on it or whatever, investigator, and the kids are never calling to figure out what happened, maybe?
Yeah. They never called the police to check on the progress of the case, nor did they express much concern about catching the killers. And it wasn't long before the police began to suspect that Eric and Lyle weren't the grieving sons that they appeared to be. By early 1990, the investigation into the murders of Jose and Kitty Menendez had stalled. The mob hit theory had fallen apart as detectives realized that the crime scene was far too messy to be a professional job. Mob hits are typically clean and quick, but the Menendez murders was a bloodbath. It was personal and emotional and full of rage. And not only that, but I think for it to be a mob hit, usually they leave, I mean, I don't know if they would leave Kitty behind as a witness, but I just feel like a lot of times they do this to send a message and the message has to be seen by someone. So I don't know. I just feel like with mob hits, it's more common for the wife to be left out of the kill. But anyway, detectives started to look more closely at Lyle and Eric. And their extravagant spending, combined with their lack of interest in the investigation, pointed to a possible financial motive. The brothers stood to inherit $14 million from their parents, plus an additional $5 million from life insurance policies. Now, investigators discovered that Lyle and Eric had purchased shotguns just 2 days before the murders.
Idiots.
I mean, red flag. That's pretty stupid.
And the shotguns was what was used to kill them.
Of course, but they also used a stolen ID to make the purchase. And then police also learned that the brothers had hired a computer expert to erase files from their family's computer, which likely contained the most recent version of Jose's will. And the reason that's important is because I think there were threats made that because the boys were such disappointments that Jose was threatening to take them out of the will. And so in case he had made that choice, they wanted to erase that new version.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, it's not looking good. But the final piece of the puzzle fell into place when Eric confessed to his therapist, Dr. Jerome Oziel, that he and Lyle had killed their parents.
No way.
Mm-hmm. He just could not live with himself. He had been seeing Dr. Jerome Oziel for therapy since his arrest for the burglaries. And over time, he had begun to trust Oziel. And then in a moment of weakness, he confessed to the murders. And he described in detail how he and Lyle had planned and carried out the killings.
So did the guy just immediately call the police?
No, because they had a patient-client privilege.
That's what I thought you were going to say.
But he explained to the doctor that they tried to make it look like a mob hit by shooting their parents in the knees and then how they disposed of the guns and the evidence. Like, there were literal shotgun shells in the boys' car, and the police never checked the car during their investigation. Otherwise, they would have found the shotgun shells in their car. Now, when Lyle found out that Eric had confessed, he was furious. And according to Oziel, Lyle threatened to kill him if he told anyone about Eric's confession. So, fearing for his safety, Dr. Oziel had his mistress, Judalon Smith, come into the office and listen in on the next session as a witness. Kind of like, if something happens to me, you're at least here to hear what goes on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Judalon, feeling threatened by Oziel's abusive behavior towards her, eventually is the one who went to the police with that information. So it was Judalon, the mistress of the therapist, that ended up being the one to tell the police, hey, these boys have admitted to it. So at that point, armed with this new evidence, the police then obtained a search warrant for these tapes of Eric's confession, which were being kept in a safety deposit box. So Dr. Jerome Oziel recorded almost everything. However, there was a part where they were walking outside while Eric was confessing everything that had gone on. And then Dr. Jerome Oziel was like, let's go into my office and talk, and then recorded it without Eric knowing. Wow. So there's a part that was, you know, confessed that was only heard by Dr. Oziel. But then when Judilon showed up and heard it through the door, she was the one that ultimately went to the police. She knew that the tapes were recorded and in the safety deposit box. She is really the one who kind of blew this case wide open.
It's almost like that guy probably said, though, hey, come listen, and then you go tell because I can't.
I mean, that could be true. I don't think it's likely, though. I think Judilon Smith was a mistress, and maybe she wanted more from Dr. Oziel than he was willing to give because he had a wife and child. And maybe this was her way of being like, well, I'm going to go to the police and talk about this then. Because just as like a scorned lover type mm-hmm. of thing. I mean, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I think
I like
they're all plausible theories. So on March 8th of 1990, Lyle Menendez was arrested outside his Beverly Hills home. And Eric, who was at a tennis tournament in Israel, was called back to the U.S. to surrender to authorities. Oh, also, I want to mention that because there were these tapes, originally it was thought that they would be protected by that client-patient privilege, right? Like HIPAA laws or whatever protects you from not, you know, having that used against you in court. Mm-hmm. But because Lyle threatened Dr. Oziel's life, the client-patient privilege was then just washed away, like canceled, because you can't threaten his life. Yeah. So he kind of screwed himself over there. So the Menendez brothers' trial would become one of the most sensationalized legal battles in American history. The media coverage was relentless, and the case quickly became a national obsession. Lyle and Eric were charged with first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder, and if convicted, they faced the death penalty. The defense team, led by Leslie Abramson, knew that they couldn't deny that the brothers had killed their parents. So instead, they presented a defense based on years of sexual, physical, and emotional abuse at the hands of Jose Menendez. Leslie painted a picture of a family torn apart by secrets. And according to the defense, Jose had been sexually abusing both Lyle and Eric for years. And Kitty had known about the abuse, but had done nothing to stop it. The defense argued that the brothers had killed their parents out of fear and desperation. They believed that their father was planning to kill them to prevent them from going public with the abuse. And Eric and Lyle both took the stand during the trial, providing graphic and emotional testimony about the abuse that they had suffered. They described how Jose had raped them, used inanimate objects to sexually assault them, and kept them in constant states of fear. Kitty, they claimed, was an alcoholic who turned a blind eye to her husband's actions and even enabled the abuse. Lyle, in particular, testified about the pressure he felt to live up to his father's expectations. He recounted how Jose had forced him to wear a toupee to hide his premature balding and how nothing he ever did was ever good enough. Eric spoke about the emotional toll of the abuse and how he had lived in constant fear of his father and how he tried to confide in his mother only to be dismissed. The defense strategy was clear. They wanted the jury to see the brothers as victims of a lifetime of abuse who had acted out of fear rather than greed. Now, the prosecution, led by Deputy District Attorney Pamela Bozanich, presented a very different narrative.
Real quick. Mm-hmm. Sorry to interrupt.
Go ahead.
You know, if they wouldn't have acted out of such greed after the fact, you would almost have to sit there and feel empathetic, like, man, were they, like, is there any proof they were getting raped or sexually abused and, like, obviously all this other stuff? And it's not that it ever makes killing okay, but it's like, I don't know, it makes you think, mm-hmm. but the greed afterward kind of negates it. Like when you bought three Rolexes 3 days later and all this other stuff, it's like, man, that kind of tarnishes your alibi.
Yeah, it definitely makes you wonder like what the motive really was, because then it's like, oh, well, that makes sense to the outsider looking in, not knowing about what was going on behind closed doors. But the thing is, the brothers had family come and testify to witnessing some of the abuse that the boys endured. So one of their cousins came forward and testified that she remembered when one of the boys was like 8 years old and told the cousin that their dad had been touching them down there and was like graphic about the detail. And then another family member testified about the abuse that they that they endured. Like, one of the boys wasn't a great swimmer, so Jose held him underwater to force him to learn how to swim better. And then there was one time when Eric was crying, and he was maybe 6 or 7 years old, and Jose wanted him to stop crying, so he punched him with a closed fist to try and get Eric to stop crying. Now, of course, this just made Eric cry more. He's 6 or 7 years old. Even 10, 12 years old, that's horrific.
Right.
So all these family members came out and testified to witnessing some of the abuse that the boys endured, and not one person came forward as a character witness for Jose or Kitty to say that Jose was actually a good guy. And I don't know if there was any about Kitty, but I know for sure there were none for Jose.
Interesting. Okay, sorry to interrupt you. What were you saying?
No worries. So the defense, the prosecuting attorney argued that the Menendez brothers had killed their parents for financial gain. And they pointed to that extravagant spending spree that followed the murders as evidence that Lyle and Eric were motivated by greed, not fear. And Pamela Bozanich argued that the brothers had carefully planned the murders, purchasing the shotguns in advance and staging the crime scene to look like a mob hit. She dismissed the claims of abuse as fabricated, this fabricated defense attorney strategy to garner sympathy from the jury. And the prosecution painted Lyle as the mastermind behind the murders, with Eric following his lead. The trial was a media circus with live television coverage, constant updates on the proceedings. It was a circus. It was all over. You couldn't miss it. And the brothers became this tabloid fodder, and public opinion was sharply divided. There was even an SNL skit of, they were constantly mocked. Like, while this was going on, SNL did a skit on the brothers because they were in this trial in like pastel sweaters. And it was clear that their defense was trying to make them look like boys and not so much as men. So they're coming to court in like these collared shirts with pastel sweaters, like they're ready to go to the country club. But a lot of people kind of saw through that. And so some people believed the brothers' claims of abuse, while others saw them as these spoiled rich kids who murdered their parents for money. So after
both of which could be true.
Right. And honestly, I kind of think they can both be true at the same time.
Me too. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. So after months of testimony and evidence, the trial ended in a deadlock. The jury was unable to reach a unanimous verdict, with some jurors believing the brothers' abuse claims and others siding with the prosecution's argument of financial motive. And as a result, the judge declared a mistrial, and the brothers faced the prospect of a retrial. But here's the interesting thing. The jury was split, with the women believing the boys and the men believing it was motivated by greed.
Is the jury trying to identify whether or not they did it, or?
No, they're like, trying to identify the charge that's appropriate. So,
okay, so everybody agrees that they did it.
Yes.
Okay, because there was obviously
they admitted to it. They,
right. Okay,
they
just making sure. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to decide between type 1 and type 2 murder?
They're trying to decide between first degree murder or manslaughter.
Okay, got it.
Or second degree, but just a lesser charge.
Listen to me say type. What an idiot.
It's okay. You're adorable. One sec. I'm getting a phone call from the kids at school. Okay, we're back. Everything's fine. Everybody's fine. But anyway, the second trial began in October of 1995. But this time, the defense was not allowed to focus as heavily on the allegations of abuse. And the media was also barred from televising the proceedings. And so the public's interest in the case had waned somewhat by this point. Now, the prosecution stuck to its original argument that Lyle and Eric had killed their parents for financial gain. And this time, the defense's strategy wasn't as effective without the emotional testimony about the abuse. And the jury found both brothers guilty of first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder. So the uproar about this is that is essential to understanding why this crime took place, right? How can you decide that the abuse allegations aren't allowed? Because now all the jury is left to believe is, of course, this is done for greed.
Right. I mean, like on the other side, what if you said, hey, nothing about money is allowed?
Right.
You can't remove half of the story.
Right. It's right. Weird. Half of the evidence, pertinent evidence, witness testimony. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, it definitely came as a shock. And I almost wonder if this was an attempt by the judge and DA. Now, this is just my opinion, but at around the same time, the OJ trial was going on, and OJ was famously acquitted for the murder of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman. And this was also after the LA riots had taken place. And so I just think, I wonder if this was the judge or the DAs or the city, whatever, their attempt to be like, well, we obviously might have screwed up a little bit with OJ. Obviously, this man was acquitted. We can't let these guys go too, or everyone's going to think you can just get away with murder in this town. So I don't know. Part of me wonders, just the conspiracy theorist in me wonders if part of the decisions to leave the emotional or the abuse evidence out was motivated by that.
It's interesting.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, on July 2nd of 1996, Lyle and Eric Menendez were sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The death penalty had been taken off the table, but the brothers would spend the rest of their lives behind bars. For the first 22 years of their imprisonment, Lyle and Eric Menendez were housed in separate prisons. So despite their close bond, they were not allowed to see each other, and they communicated primarily through letters and through their wives, both of whom had married the brothers while they were in prison.
Man, so, that's love after lockup crap. I don't really believe in that.
Listen, this is crazy. So Lyle actually got married twice. First to a girl named Anna Erickson, who I think was a model. They got married in 1996. She sent him a letter during the trial, and I guess they just kept in touch. But they eventually got married despite never even touching each other. And they were actually married, I guess if you can call it that, in a not-so-legal ceremony over the phone. But this marriage ended in divorce in 2001 after Anna discovered that Lyle had been corresponding with other women. Now, can you imagine?
This is just silly.
Can you imagine starting a relationship with someone in prison, marrying them, despite the fact that they're never expected to be released from prison? You're there for them. You send them money. Surely you stay faithful despite the fact that you get no physical intimacy or even as much as a hug or a kiss from your own spouse, only for them to go and cheat on you. I would simply throw myself from a tall roof.
If you're the person that married him, though, what are you thinking? Did they get money from the Menendez?
Oh, I doubt it.
Do the Menendez still have money?
I don't think so.
Okay, then that person's stupid anyways.
Well, Anna and Lyle split in 2000.
Can't be an unpopular opinion. Like, people listening to this got to be like, yeah, no doubt. If any of you out there are listening and you're in a relationship right now with somebody in prison that you weren't in a relationship with before prison, give us a shout through the Mama Mystery website, please. I'd love to hear about it.
Oh, man. So Anna and Lyle split in 2001, but he remarried to Rebecca Sneed in 2003, and the two remain together to this day. Eric married Tammy Sackerman in 1999 after years of corresponding as pen pals, and Tammy has remained a devoted wife, even writing a book about their relationship, which is called They Said We'd Never Make It, My Life with Eric Menendez. In interviews, she has described their relationship as a dream come true, despite the unusual circumstances of their marriage. And Tammy actually has a daughter. So Tammy was married prior to meeting Eric, and her husband at the time was alive and well. They were married when Tammy was corresponding with Eric, and he knew that they were writing letters back and forth. And then the husband died, and then Tammy's, you know, moved closer to the prison where Eric was housed, started bringing her daughter to these visits. And so Eric kind of became this girl's father because the girl didn't remember her dad. He died when she was really little. So Eric kind of became a father to this little girl. And now she has an Instagram called, I want to say it's Set Eric Menendez Free. Like, that's the name of the Instagram profile. And she shares a lot about her experience having Eric as her dad and what the visits have been like.
Eric has her dad when she goes to visit him in prison?
Yeah, and during phone calls. And so, like, she moved her daughter, would take her daughter to the prison, I think, daily to visit Eric. And he would help her with her homework. And he would help her, like, overcome her heartache when she'd have her heart broken by boys and things like that. They'd play games, and she would, you know, interact with his friends, which are other inmates. But they would.
I just don't get it. You know, it's just me.
To
each their own. Having a pen pal in prison that's like you've never met and stuff, to me, like you might as well go start a relationship with an AI person and just text with them.
I get it.
I don't understand it. It's just me. But hey, whatever floats your boat.
Yeah, I don't know. Now, for years, the brothers lived in isolation, each serving their sentences in different maximum security prisons. But in 2018, after more than two decades apart, Lyle was transferred to the same prison as Eric. And the reunion was very emotional, with the brothers hugging and crying upon seeing each other for the first time
in
22 years.
Man, that's pretty nuts.
You know, I cannot even imagine that, because they grew up in this household. All they really had were each other.
Going through crazy shit.
Going through crazy shit, committing crazy shit, committing these crazy crimes. And then everything that followed after, going through the trial, and then to be found guilty of first-degree murder, you're going to spend the rest of your life in prison, and you're never going to see your brother again.
It's the only other person in the world that you would be able to truly relate to.
Mm-hmm. And trust.
Yeah, I don't know if you'd trust if you're Lyle, because Eric ratted on them to his therapist. But yeah, I get what you're saying.
Yeah, I get that. And honestly, I kind of chuckle that you said that, because that's been a point of conversation with Lyle and Eric. Like, in their interviews, Eric has said that he would understand if Lyle never loved him again or tried. Like, it's super sad, honestly. Mm-hmm. But Eric couldn't live with himself. He said that he was contemplating suicide because what he had done was just eating him alive. He couldn't sleep. Damn. He was constantly having nightmares. Like, that is not the mentality of, in my opinion, a true sociopath.
He
had deep, deep regret for what he did.
Yeah. Which makes me think that that's a person that maybe probably did go through all of that stuff and battled with how to handle it and got to the point of, okay, let's kill him. Mm-hmm. And then was actually in some degree had a normalcy in their head and says, okay, we probably went too far with killing them. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's so crazy.
You also have to remember, these boys were like 18 and 21 at the time that this happened. I'm pretty sure that was their ages. I think Eric was 18 and Lyle, I think, was at least 21, at max 23. I can't remember the age difference off the top of my head, but that's really, really young. I was making stupid decisions when I was that age. Not as stupid as killing my parents, but like, I look back at that person and I'm like, that girl didn't know which way was up, you know? And so to make such a life-altering decision, I just don't think that they really thought it through. I mean, they were adults and you got to hold them responsible, but I don't know. I believe that they suffered. I do believe what they've said about the abuse that they endured. They have backup evidence. They have family that testified in their defense. They have the support of their family. Even the parents of Jose's mom supported the boys.
And then Jose had nobody come to his support of like, oh, well, he was a good dude. He would have never done any of this stuff.
Right.
So I tend to believe it also.
So since that reunion, they have been housed in the same unit and they are able to spend time together daily. And despite their grim circumstances, the Menendez brothers have tried to make the best of their lives in prison. They've continued to appeal their convictions, though without much success. Then in 2023, lawyers for the Menendez brothers announced the discovery of a letter written by Eric Menendez to a cousin, Andy Cano, 8 months before the murders, in which he goes into detail about the ongoing abuse by their father. Eric writes in the letter in part, quote, "I've been trying to avoid Dad. It's still happening, Andy, but it's worse for me now. Every night I stay up thinking he might come in. I'm afraid. He's crazy. He's warned me 100 times about telling anyone, especially Lyle," end quote. So there's this tangible proof that he was suffering from abuse prior to the murders. So that would negate the prosecuting attorney's argument that this was all made up. Now, the brothers claim this letter supports their original testimony during their first trial, alleging the abuse, obviously. But some experts question the authenticity of the letter because Andy Cano passed away 20 years ago, and then this letter just mysteriously reappeared. So some experts want tests done on it to determine if it really is from the 80s when they're alleging it was written. Cliff Gardner, one of the brothers' lawyers, told CBS News that the new evidence backs up the abuse claims and lessens their culpability. He argues that the brothers should have been convicted of manslaughter rather than first-degree murder, meaning that they would have been freed from prison long ago. The other piece of evidence is a sworn affidavit from Roy Rosello. I think it's actually Rosello. But anyway, a former member of the Puerto Rican boy band Menudo, in which he says he was also abused by the brother's father, Jose.
Wow.
Now, both pieces of evidence were highlighted in a habeas corpus petition that Gardner filed in May of 2023, arguing that the brothers' convictions should be overturned based on these new pieces of evidence and the way the second trial was handled, because they weren't allowed to even talk about the abuse. CBS News reported that the LA County District Attorney's Office is investigating the claims in the petition, and the LA County DA's office has been reviewing the case and the new evidence and recently said they wanted an extension on the time needed to make their decision, which gives me chills because I feel like, in my opinion, that means that there's some hope and that maybe we should be hearing their response here pretty soon. But it seems like they're really putting some time into looking at this new evidence and trying to decide if they deserve to have their conviction vacated to a lesser conviction of manslaughter.
And potentially get some freedom in their life.
Yes, and if that is the case, they will have already served the maximum amount of time that a manslaughter charge carries, so they would be set free.
I was curious how old they were now. They're 56 and 53, mm-hmm. and it did 21 and 18 was how old they were.
Okay. Now, over the years, public opinion on the Menendez brothers has shifted. And at the time of their trial, many people viewed them as greedy, spoiled brats who killed their parents for money. But in recent years, there's been a growing sentiment that perhaps the brothers were telling the truth about the abuse that they endured. The Me Too movement and increased awareness of childhood trauma have led some to reevaluate the case with a more empathetic lens. Documentaries, books, and podcasts have kept the Menendez case alive in the public consciousness, and more people are now questioning whether justice was truly served. So the reason why this case has even blown up more, I think, recently is because of all this Netflix stuff coming out. So Netflix just released a series called Monsters, and the series itself is called Monsters, and it showcases different stories. So they showcased Jeffrey Dahmer, and now they're showcasing Lyle and Eric Menendez. And it just recently came out. There's a ton of buzz about it all over TikTok, social media, just everywhere. And the boys have come out to say that, or I should say the brothers, they're not boys now, but the brothers have come out to say that some of the stuff depicted in the series is inaccurate. But the producer, which I think is Ryan Murphy, he has caught a lot of flack for being kind of salacious in a lot of his reproductions of stories. But he makes a point to say that these stories and these productions that he makes are to tell the viewpoint from multiple different views. So you're seeing the view of Dominic Dunn, who was one of the main reporters on the story, and you're seeing it from the viewpoint of the parents and the boys. It's not just the brother's story that he's trying to tell.
I've always been curious if, like, can the producer just say, I'm going to do a story on that? And do they not have to worry about slander or bad information or misinformation or anything? Do they just get to do it? Can you just take a legal case and just say, I'm going to do a story on this and I'm going to sell it to Netflix?
I guess so. I mean, if it's based on like multiple testimonies and different people's opinions, then...
Like Casey Anthony's documentary.
Yeah.
You can just come out and just do whatever you want.
That one was her,
right?
Well, yeah, the Casey Anthony with her coming out with her documentary on Peacock, she really slammed her parents. I'm sure that her father could take legal repercussions, but I don't know how far I would go because you have
HBO, there's a Tiger documentary in Tiger Woods. It's two part. It's mm-hmm. phenomenal. If you're into sports, if you're into the drama of all this, I mean, I think these type of people would enjoy it. The Tiger documentary, he supposedly completely says, I got nothing to do with it, and there's all kinds of misinformation and blah, blah. But, I mean, he hasn't done anything about it, so I'm just curious mm-hmm. if you can just say what you want. I don't know. Doesn't it seem like slander would be a possibility?
Well, the actual definition of slander is the action or crime of making a false spoken statement damaging to a person's reputation.
Yeah, so if you create a whole entire documentary that's completely inaccurate in your opinion—
But that's the thing. That's an opinion. So you're making false spoken statements that are damaging to a person's reputation. But if everything is already out there and you're just kind of retelling it, then maybe you're not, maybe they can't hold you.
I mean, like us podcasting, I guess.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Exactly. That's why I said, don't come for me. Okay. And now to wrap this up, the story of Lyle and Eric Menendez is obviously a tragic one, no matter how you look at it. Whether you believe that they were cold-blooded killers motivated by greed or victims of a lifetime of abuse who acted out of fear, the fact remains that their lives and the lives of their parents were shattered by violence. And decades later, the Menendez brothers remain in prison, but their story continues to captivate and divide public opinion. The question of whether they were guilty of murder or driven to do it by the trauma they suffered will likely remain a topic of debate for years to come. Now, whatever ends up happening with this habeas corpus petition, I will let you guys know. I'll be sure to update you, because if they get released, that will be
earth-shattering.
It will be big. It will be a big effing deal. So, and if they don't, then that'll be pretty, like, depressing, I'm sure, for them. I'm sure it'll be very disappointing and shattering for them also.
I want to watch that documentary. That's interesting.
I think you should.
This one's really interesting to me.
I watched it. I watched both. So I watched the Menendez Brothers series, the Monster series, and I thought it was very fascinating. I do feel a little bit like they kind of portrayed Lyle to be a lot more aggressive than he actually is in person. Just from footage I've seen of Lyle, he doesn't seem to be this like almost Christian Bale type character, or like whoever that guy is from American Psycho. I can't think of his name. Maybe I already said it. But anyway, he comes off as like really unhinged in the Monsters docuseries. I have a hard time believing he was that aggressive. Mm-hmm. But then the documentary that came out, which is actually supported by the brothers, I mean, it really kind of says a lot of the same stuff. And it is very interesting. I do believe the brothers. I'm curious to know what you think. So if you're listening on Spotify, there should be an option to comment on this episode. So if you have an opinion one way or the other, I'd love to hear it. You can also let us know on our Mama Mystery Instagram page, or you can send us a message on mamamystery.com. That'll do it.
This was a wild one.
Mm-hmm.
The Menendez brothers. Mama Mystery. Out.
Bye.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever find yourself playing the budgeting game? Well, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive, you can find options that fit your budget and potentially lower your bills. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Not available in all states.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week.
Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.